Sykes with a tremendous oath. If he was left alive till I came, I'd grind his skull under the iron heel of my boot into as many grains as there are hairs upon his head. "What if I did it?" cried Fagin, almost in a yell. "I, that know so much and could hang so many besides myself." "I don't know," replied Sykes, clenching his teeth and turning white at the mere suggestion. "I'd do something in the jail that'd get me put in irons, and if I was tried along with you, I'd fall upon you with them in the open court and beat your brains out afore the people." "I should have such strength," muttered the robber, poising his brawny arm, "that I could smash your head as if a loaded wagon had gone over it." "You would?" "Would I?" said the housebreaker. "Try me. If it was Charlie, or the Dodger, or Bet, or—" "I don't care who," replied Sykes impatiently. "Whoever it was, I'd serve them the same." Fagin looked hard at the robber, and motioning him to be silent, stooped over the bed upon the floor and shook the sleeper to rouse him. Sykes leant forward in his chair, looking on with his hands upon his knees, as if wondering much what all this questioning and preparation was to end in.
"Bolter! Bolter! Poor lad!"
said Fagin, looking up with an expression of devilish anticipation, and speaking slowly and with marked emphasis.
"He's tired. Tired with watching for her so long. Watching for her, Bill."
"What do you mean?" asked Sykes, drawing back. Fagin made no answer, but bending over the sleeper again, hauled him into a sitting posture. When his assumed name had been repeated several times, Noah rubbed his eyes, and giving a heavy yawn, looked sleepily about him.
"Tell me that again, once again, just for him to hear,"
said the Jew, pointing to Sykes as he spoke.
"Tell you what?"
asked the sleepy Noah, shaking himself pettishly.
"That about Nancy,"
said Fagin, clutching Sykes by the wrist, as if to prevent his leaving the house before he had heard enough.
"You followed her?"
"Yes."
"To London Bridge?"
"Yes."
"Where she met two people?"
"So she did.
A gentleman and a lady that she had gone to of her own accord before, who asked her to give up all her pals and Monks first, which she did, and to describe him, which she did, and tell her what house it was that we meet at and go to, which she did, and where it could be best watched from, which she did, and what time the people went there, which she did. She did all this. She told it all, every word, without a threat, without a murmur. She did she not?"
cried Fagin, half mad with fury.
"All right," replied Noah, scratching his head. "That's just what it was."
"What did they say about last Sunday?"
"About last Sunday," replied Noah, considering. "Why, I told you that before."
"Again, tell it again,"
cried Fagin, tightening his grasp on Sykes and brandishing his other hand aloft as the foam flew from his lips.
"They asked her,"
said Noah, who, as he grew more wakeful, seemed to have a dawning perception who Sykes was.
"They asked her why she didn't come last Sunday, as she promised. She said she couldn't."
"Why? Why? Tell him that."
"Because she was forcibly kept at home by Bill, the man she'd told them of before," replied Noah.
"What more of him?" cried Fagin. "What more of the man she had told them of before? Tell him that! Tell him that!"
"Why, that she couldn't very easily get out of doors unless he knew where she was going to," said Noah. "And so the first time she went to see the lady, she—" It made me laugh when she said it, that it did. "She gave him a drink of laudanum."
"Hell's fire!" cried Sykes, breaking fiercely from the Jew. "Let me go."
Flinging the old man from him, he rushed from the room and darted wildly and furiously up the stairs.
"Bill! Bill!" cried Fagin, following him hastily. "A word! Only a word!"
The word would not have been exchanged, but that the housebreaker was unable to open the door, on which he was expending fruitless oaths and violence, when the Jew came panting up.
"Let me out," said Sykes. "Don't speak to me, it's not safe. Let me out, I say." "Hear me speak a word,"
rejoined Fagin, laying his hand upon the lock.
"You won't be—"
"Well," replied the other,
"you won't be too violent, Bill?"
The day was breaking, and there was light enough for the men to see each other's faces. They exchanged one brief glance. There was a fire in the eyes of both, which could not be mistaken.
"I mean,"
said Fagin, showing that he felt all disguise was now useless,
not too violent for safety. Be crafty, Bill, and not too bold.
Sikes made no reply, but pulling open the door, of which Fagin had turned the lock, dashed into the silent streets. Without one pause or moment's consideration, without once turning his head to the right or left, or raising his eyes to the sky, or lowering them to the ground, but looking straight before him with savage resolution, his teeth so tightly compressed that the strained jaw seemed starting through his skin, the robber held on his headlong course, nor muttered a word nor relaxed a muscle, until he reached his own door. He opened it softly with a key, strode lightly up the stairs, and entering his own room, double-locked the door, and lifting a heavy table against it, drew back the curtain of the bed. The girl was lying half-dressed upon it. He had roused her from her sleep, for she raised herself with a hurried and startled look.
"Get up," said the man.
"It is you, Bill," said the girl, with an expression of pleasure at his return.
"It is," was the reply. "Get up."
There was a candle burning, but the man hastily drew it from the candlestick and hurled it under the grate. Seeing the faint light of early day without, the girl rose to undraw the curtain.
"Let it be," said Sikes, thrusting his hand before her. "There's light enough for what I've got to do."
"Bill," said the girl in the low voice of alarm, "why do you look like that at me?" The robber sat regarding her for a few seconds with dilated nostrils and heaving breast, and then, grasping her by the head and throat, dragged her into the middle of the room, and looking once towards the door, placed his heavy hand upon her mouth.
"Bill! Bill!" gasped the girl, wrestling with the strength of mortal fear. I won't scream or cry, not once. Hear me. Speak to me. Tell me what I have done."
"You know, you she-devil," returned the robber, suppressing his breath. "You were watched tonight. Every word you said was heard."
"Then spare my life, for the love of heaven, as I spared yours," rejoined the girl, clinging to him. "Bill, dear Bill, you cannot have the heart to kill me. Oh, think of all I have given up. Only this one night for you. You shall have time to think and save yourself this crime. I will not loose my hold. You cannot throw me off. Bill, Bill, for dear God's sake, for your own, for mine, stop before you spill my blood. I have been true to you. Upon my guilty soul, I have."
The man struggled violently to release his arms, but those of the girl were clasped round his, and tear as he would, he could not tear them away.
"Bill," cried the girl, striving to lay her head upon his breast, "the gentleman and that dear lady told me tonight of a home in some foreign country where I could end my days in solitude and peace. Let me see them again, and beg them on my knees to show the same mercy and goodness to you, and let us both leave this dreadful place, and far apart lead better lives, and forget how we have lived except in prayers, and never see each other more. It is never too late to repent. They told me so. I feel it now. But we must have time. A little time."
The housebreaker freed one arm and grasped his pistol. The certainty of immediate detection if he fired flashed across his mind even in the midst of his fury, and he beat it twice with all the force he could summon upon the upturned face that almost touched his own. She staggered and fell, nearly blinded with the blood that rained down from a deep gash in her forehead, but raising herself with difficulty on her knees, drew from her bosom a white handkerchief, Rose Maley's own, and holding it up in her folded hands, as high towards heaven as her feeble strength would allow, breathed one prayer for mercy to her Maker. It was a ghastly figure to look upon, the murderer staggering backward to the wall, and shutting out the sight with his hand, seized a heavy club and struck her down. Chapter 48. The Flight of Sikes. Of all bad deeds that, under cover of the darkness, had been committed within wide London's bounds since night hung over it, that was the worst. Of all the horrors that rose with an ill scent upon the morning air, that was the foulest and most cruel. The sun, the bright sun that brings back not light alone, but new life and hope and freshness to man, burst upon the crowded city in clear and radiant glory.
through costly coloured glass and paper-mended window, through cathedral dome and rotten crevice, it shed its equal ray. It lighted up the room where the murdered woman lay. It did. He tried to shut it out, but it would stream in. If the sight had been a ghastly one in the dull morning, what was it now, in all that brilliant light? He had not moved. He had been afraid to stir. There had been a moan and motion of the hand, and with terror added to rage he had struck, and struck again. Once he threw a rug over it, but it was worse to fancy the eyes and imagine them moving towards him than to see them glaring upward, as if watching the reflection of the pool of gore that quivered and danced in the sunlight on the ceiling. He had plucked it off again, and there was the body, mere flesh and blood, no more, but such flesh and so much blood. He struck a light, kindled a fire, and thrust the club into it. There was hair upon the end, which blazed and shrunk into a light cinder, and, caught by the air, whirled up the chimney. Even that frightened him, sturdy as he was, but he held the weapon till it broke, and then piled it on the coals to burn away and smoulder into ashes. He washed himself and rubbed his clothes. There were spots that would not be removed, but he cut the pieces out and burnt them. How those stains were dispersed about the room! The very feet of the dog were bloody. All this time he had never once turned his back upon the corpse, no, not for a moment. Such preparations completed, he moved backward towards the door, dragging the dog with him lest he should soil his feet anew and carry out new evidences of the crime into the streets. He shut the door softly, locked it, took the key, and left the house. He crossed over and glanced up at the window to be sure that nothing was visible from the outside. There was the curtain, still drawn, which she would have opened to admit the light she never saw again. It lay nearly under there. He knew that. God, how the sun poured down upon the very spot. The glance was instantaneous. It was a relief to have got free of the room. He whistled on the dog and walked rapidly away. He went through Islington, strode up the hill at Highgate, on which stands the stone in honour of Whittington, turned down to Highgate Hill, unsteady of purpose and uncertain where to go, struck off to the right again almost as soon as he began to descend it, and taking the footpath across the fields, skirted Caen Wood, and so came out on Hampstead Heath. Traversing the hollow by the Vale of Health, he mounted the opposite bank, and crossing the road which joins the villages of Hampstead and Highgate, made along the remaining portion of the heath to the fields at North End, in one of which he laid himself down under a hedge and slept. Soon he was up again, and away, not far into the country, but back towards London by the high road, then back again, then over another part of the same ground as he already traversed, then wandering up and down in fields, and lying on ditches' brinks to rest, and starting up to make for some other spot, and do the same, and ramble on again. Where could he go that was near and not too public to get some meat and drink? Hendon, that was a good place, not far off and out of most people's way. Thither he directed his steps, running sometimes, and sometimes with a strange perversity, loitering at a snail's pace, or stopping altogether and idly breaking the hedges with his stick. But when he got there, all the people he met, the very children at the doors, seemed to view him with suspicion. Back he turned again, without the courage to purchase bit or drop, though he had tasted no food for many hours. And once more he lingered on the heath, uncertain where to go. He wandered over miles and miles of ground, and still came back to the old place. Morning and noon had passed, and the day was on the wane, and still he rambled to and fro, and up and down, and round, and still lingered about the same spot. At last he got away, and shaped his course for Hatfield. It was 9 o'clock at night, when the man, quite tired out, and the dog, limping and lame from the unaccustomed exercise, turned down the hill by the church of the quiet village, and plodding along the little street, crept into a small public house, whose scanty light had guided them to the spot. There was a fire in the tap-room, and some country labourers were drinking before it. They made room for the stranger, but he sat down in the farthest corner and ate and drank alone, or rather with his dog, to whom he cast a morsel of food from time to time. The conversation of the men assembled here turned upon the neighbouring land and farmers, and when those topics were exhausted, upon the age of some old man who had been buried on the previous Sunday, the young men present considering him very old, and the old men present declaring him to have been quite young. Not older, one white-haired grandfather said, than he was, with 10 or 15 years of life in him at least, if he had taken care, if he had taken care. There was nothing to attract attention or excite alarm in this. The robber, after paying his reckoning, sat silent and unnoticed in his corner, and had almost dropped asleep when he was half-wakened by the noisy entrance of a newcomer. This was an antic fellow, half peddler and half mountebank, who travelled about the country on foot to vend hones, strops, razors, washballs, harness paste, medicine for dogs and horses, cheap perfumery, cosmetics and such like wares, which he carried in a case slung on his back. His entrance was the signal for various homely jokes with the countrymen, which slackened not until he had made his supper and opened his box of treasures, when he ingeniously contrived to unite business with amusement. "And what be that stuff? Good to eat, Harry?" asked a grinning countryman, pointing to some composition cakes in one corner. "This," said the fellow, producing one, "this is the infallible and invaluable composition for removing all sorts of stain, rust, dirt, mildew, spick, speck, spot or spatter from silk, satin, linen, cambric, cloth, crepe, stuff, carpet, merino, muslin, bombazine or woolen stuff. Wine stains, fruit stains, beer stains, water stains, paint stains, pitch stains, any stains, all come out at one rub with the infallible and invaluable composition. If a lady stains her honour, she has only need to swallow one cake and she's cured at once, for it's poison. If a gentleman wants to prove this, he has only need to bolt one little square, and he has put it beyond question, for it's quite as satisfactory as a pistol bullet, and a great deal nastier in the flavour, consequently the more credit in taking it. One penny a square. With all these virtues, one penny a square." There were two buyers directly, and more of the listeners plainly hesitated. The vendor, observing this, increased in loquacity. "It's all bought up as fast as it can be made," said the fellow. "There are 14 water mills, 6 steam engines, and a galvanic battery always a-working upon it, and they can't make it fast enough, though the men work so hard that they die off, and the widows is pensioned directly, with £20 a year for each of the children, and a premium of 50 for twins. One penny a square, 2 halfpence is all the same, and 4 farthings is received with joy. One penny a square, wine stains, fruit stains, beer stains, water stains, paint stains, pitch stains, mud stains, blood stains. Here is a stain upon the hat of a gentleman in company that I'll take clean out before he can order me a pint of ale." "Huh?" cried Sykes, starting up. "Give that back." "I'll take it clean out, sir," replied the man, winking to the company, "before you can come across the room to get it. Gentlemen all, observe the dark stain upon this gentleman's hat, no wider than a shilling, but thicker than a half-crown. Whether it's a wine stain, fruit stain, beer stain, water stain, paint stain, pitch stain, mud stain, or blood stain." The man got no further, for Sykes, with a hideous imprecation, overthrew the table, and tearing the hat from him, burst out of the house. With the same perversity of feeling and irresolution that had fastened upon him, despite himself, all day, the murderer, finding that he was not followed, and that they most probably considered him some drunken, sullen fellow, turned back up the town, and getting out of the glare of the lamps of a stagecoach that was standing in the street, was walking past when he recognised the mail from London, and saw that it was standing at the little post office. He almost knew what was to come. But he crossed over and listened. The guard was standing at the door waiting for the letter bag. A man dressed like a gamekeeper came up at the moment, and he handed him a basket which lay ready on the pavement. "That's for your people," said the guard. "Now look alive in there, will you? Damn that ere bag, it weren't ready night afore last. This won't do, you know." "Anything new up in town, Ben?" asked the gamekeeper, drawing back to the window shutters the better to admire the horses.
"No, nothing that I knows on," replied the man, pulling on his gloves. "Corn's up a little. I heard talk of a murder, too, down Spitalfields way, but I don't reckon much upon it."
"Oh, that's quite true," said a gentleman inside who was looking out of the window, "and a dreadful murder it was."
"Was it, sir?" rejoined the guard, touching his hat. "Man or woman, pray, sir?"
"A woman," replied the gentleman. "It is supposed..."
"Now, Ben," replied the coachman impatiently.
"Damn that ear bag," said the guard.
"Are you gone to sleep in there?"
"Coming,"
cried the office keeper, running out.
"Coming," growled the guard.
"Ah, and so's the young woman of property that's going to take a fancy to me, but I don't know when. Here, give hold." "All right." The horn sounded a few cheerful notes, and the coach was gone. Sykes remained standing in the street, apparently unmoved by what he had just heard, and agitated by no stronger feeling than a doubt where to go. At length he went back again, and took the road which leads from Hatfield to St. Albans. He went on doggedly, but as he left the town behind him and plunged into the solitude and darkness of the road, he felt a dread and awe creeping upon him, which shook him to the core. Every object before him, substance or shadow, still or moving, took the semblance of some fearful thing. But these fears were nothing compared to the sense that haunted him of that morning's ghastly figure following at his heels. He could trace its shadow in the gloom, supply the smallest item of the outline, and note how stiff and solemn it seemed to stalk along. He could hear its garments rustling in the leaves, and every breath of wind came laden with that last low cry. If he stopped, it did the same. If he ran, it followed, not running too. That would have been a relief, but like a corpse endowed with the mere machinery of life, and borne on one slow, melancholy wind that never rose or fell. At times he turned with desperate determination, resolved to beat this phantom off, though it should look him dead. But the hair rose on his head, and his blood stood still, for it had turned with him and was behind him then. He had kept it before him that morning, but it was behind now, always. He leaned his back against a bank, and felt that it stood above him, visibly out against the cold night sky. He threw himself upon the road, on his back upon the road. At his head it stood, silent, erect, and still, a living gravestone, with its epitaph in blood. Let no man talk of murderers escaping justice, and hint that Providence must sleep. There were 20 score of violent deaths in one long minute of that agony of fear. There was a shed in a field he passed that offered shelter for the night. Before the door were 3 tall poplar trees, which made it very dark within, and the wind moaned through them with a dismal wail. He could not walk on till daylight came again, and here he stretched himself close to the wall, to undergo new torture. For now, a vision came before him, as constant and more terrible than that from which he had escaped. Those widely staring eyes, so lustreless and so glassy that he had better borne to see them than think upon them, appeared in the midst of the darkness, light in themselves, but giving light to nothing. There were but 2, but they were everywhere. If he shut out the sight, there came the room with every well-known object, some, indeed, that he would have forgotten if he had gone over its contents from memory, each in its accustomed place. The body was in its place, and its eyes were as he saw them when he stole away. He got up and rushed into the field without. The figure was behind him. He re-entered the shed and shrunk down once more. The eyes were there before he had laid himself along. And here he remained in such terror as none but he can know, trembling in every limb, and the cold sweat starting from every pore, when suddenly there arose upon the night wind the noise of distant shouting and the roar of voices mingled in alarm and wonder. Any sound of men in that lonely place, even though it conveyed a real cause of alarm, was something to him. He regained his strength and energy at the prospect of personal danger, and springing to his feet, rushed into the open air. The broad sky seemed on fire. Rising into the air with showers of sparks and rolling one above the other were sheets of flame, lighting the atmosphere for miles round,
and driving clouds of smoke in the direction where he stood. The shouts grew louder as new voices swelled the roar, and he could hear the cry of fire mingled with the ringing of an alarm bell, the fall of heavy bodies, and the crackling of flames as they twined round some new obstacle and shot aloft as though refreshed by food. The noise increased as he looked. There were people there, men and women, light, bustle. It was like new life to him. He darted onward, straight, headlong, dashing through briar and brake and leaping gate and fence as madly as his dog, who careered with loud and sounding bark before him. He came upon the spot. There were half-dressed figures tearing to and fro, some endeavouring to drag the frightened horses from the stables, others driving the cattle from the yard and outhouses, and others coming laden from the burning pile amidst a shower of falling sparks and the tumbling down of red-hot beams. The apertures where doors and windows stood an hour ago disclosed a mass of raging fire. Walls rocked and crumbled into the burning well. The molten lead and iron poured down white-hot upon the ground. Women and children shrieked, and men encouraged each other with noisy shouts and cheers. The clanking of the engine pumps and the spurting and hissing of the water as it fell upon the blazing wood added to the tremendous roar. He shouted, too, till he was hoarse, and, flying from memory and himself, plunged into the thickest of the throng. Hither and thither he dived that night, now working at the pumps, and now hurrying through the smoke and flame, but never ceasing to engage himself wherever noise and men were thickest. Up and down the ladders, upon the roofs of buildings, over floors that quaked and trembled with his weight, under the lee of falling bricks and stones, in every part of that great fire was he. But he bore a charmed life, and had neither scratch nor bruise, nor weariness nor thought, till morning dawned again, and only smoke and blackened ruins remained. This mad excitement over, there returned with tenfold force the dreadful consciousness of his crime. He looked suspiciously about him, for the men were conversing in groups, and he feared to be the subject of their talk. The dog obeyed the significant beck of his finger, and they drew off stealthily together. He passed near an engine where some men were seated, and they called to him to share in their refreshment. He took some bread and meat, and as he drank a draught of beer, heard the firemen who were from London talking about the murder. "He has gone to Birmingham, they say," said one. "But they'll have him yet, for the scouts are out, and by tomorrow night there'll be a cry all through the country." He hurried off, and walked till he almost dropped upon the ground, then lay down in a lane, and had a long but broken and uneasy sleep. He wandered on again, irresolute and undecided, and oppressed with the fear of another solitary night. Suddenly he took the desperate resolution of going back to London. "There's somebody to speak to there, at all events," he thought. "A good hiding place, too. They'll never expect to nab me there after this country scent. Why can't I lie by for a week or so, and, forcing Blunt from Fagin, get abroad to France? Damn me, I'll risk it." He acted upon this impulse without delay, and, choosing the least frequented roads, began his journey back, resolved to lie concealed within a short distance of the metropolis, and entering it at dusk by a circuitous route, to proceed straight to that part of it which he had fixed on for his destination. The dog, though, if any descriptions of him were out, it would not be forgotten that the dog was missing, and had probably gone with him. This might lead to his apprehension as he passed along the streets. He resolved to drown him, and walked on looking about for a pond, picking up a heavy stone and tying it to his handkerchief as he went. The animal looked up into his master's face while these preparations were making. Whether his instinct apprehended something of their purpose, or the robber's sidelong look at him was sterner than ordinary, he skulked a little farther in the rear than usual, and cowered as he came more slowly along. When his master halted at the brink of a pool and looked round to call him, he stopped outright.
"Do you hear me call? Come here," cried Sykes.
The animal came up from the very force of habit, but as Sykes stooped to attach the handkerchief to his throat, he uttered a low growl and started back.
"Come back," said the robber.
The dog wagged his tail, but moved not. Sykes made a running noose and called him again. The dog advanced, retreated, paused an instant, turned, and scoured away at his hardest speed. The man whistled again and again and sat down and waited in the expectation that he would return. But no dog appeared, and at length he resumed his journey. Chapter 49. Monks and Mr. Brownlow at length meet, their conversation and the intelligence that interrupts it. The twilight was beginning to close in when Mr. Brownlow alighted from a hackney coach at his own door and knocked softly. The door being opened, a sturdy man got out of the coach and stationed himself on one side of the steps, while another man who had been seated on the box dismounted too and stood upon the other side. At a sign from Mr. Brownlow, they helped out a third man and, taking him between them, hurried him into the house. This man was Monks. They walked in the same manner up the stairs without speaking, and Mr. Brownlow, preceding them, led the way into a back room. At the door of this apartment, Monks, who had ascended with evident reluctance, stopped. The two men looked to the old gentleman as if for instructions.
"He knows the alternative," said Mr. Brownlow. "If he hesitates or moves a finger, but as you bid him, drag him into the street, call for the aid of the police, and impeach him as a felon in my name."
"How dare you say this of me?" asked Monks.
"How dare you urge me to it, young man?"
replied Mr. Brownlow, confronting him with a steady look.
"Are you mad enough to leave this house? Unhand him. There, sir, you are free to go, and we to follow. But I warn you, by all I hold most solemn and most sacred, that the instant you set foot in the street, that instant will I have you apprehended on a charge of fraud and robbery. I am resolute and immovable. If you are determined to be the same, your blood be upon your own head."
"By what authority am I kidnapped in the street and brought here by these dogs?" asked Monks, looking from one to the other of the men who stood beside him.
"By mine," replied Mr. Brownlow. "Those persons are indemnified by me. If you complain of being deprived of your liberty, you had power and opportunity to retrieve it as you came along, but you deemed it advisable to remain quiet. I say again, throw yourself for protection on the law. I will appeal to the law, too. But when you have gone too far to recede, do not sue to me for leniency when the power will have passed into other hands, and do not say I plunged you down the gulf into which you rushed yourself."
Monks was plainly disconcerted and alarmed besides. He hesitated.
"You will decide quickly," said Mr. Brownlow, with perfect firmness and composure, "if you wish me to prefer my charges publicly and consign you to a punishment the extent of which, although I can with a shudder foresee, I cannot control. Once more, I say, you know the way. If not, and you appeal to my forbearance and the mercy of those you have deeply injured, seat yourself without a word in that chair. It has waited for you 2 whole days."
Monks muttered some unintelligible words, but wavered still.
"You will be prompt," said Mr. Brownlow. "A word from me, and the alternative has gone for ever."
Still the man hesitated.
"I have not the inclination to parley," said Mr. Brownlow, "and as I advocate the dearest interests of others, I have not the right."
"Is there," demanded Monks with a faltering tongue, "is there no middle course?"
"None."
Monks looked at the old gentleman with an anxious eye, but reading in his countenance nothing but severity and determination, walked into the room and, shrugging his shoulders, sat down.
"Lock the door on the outside," said Mr. Brownlow to the attendants, "and come when I ring."
The men obeyed, and the two were left alone together.
"This is pretty treatment, sir," said Monks, throwing down his hat and cloak, "from my father's oldest friend."
"It is because I was your father's oldest friend, young man," returned Mr. Brownlow. "It is because the hopes and wishes of young and happy years were bound up with him, and that fair creature of his blood and kindred, who rejoined her God in youth, and left me here a solitary, lonely man. It is because he knelt with me beside his only sister's deathbed when he was yet a boy, on the morning that would, but heaven willed otherwise, have made her my young wife. It is because my seared heart clung to him from that time forth through all his trials and errors till he died. It is because old recollections and associations filled my heart and even the sight of you brings with it old thoughts of him. It is because of all these things that I am moved to treat you gently now. Yes, Edward Leaford, even now, and blush for your unworthiness who bear the name.
What has the name to do with it? Asked the other, after contemplating, half in silence and half in dogged wonder, the agitation of his companion.
What is the name to me?
Nothing, replied Mr. Brownlow, nothing to you.
But it was hers, and even at this distance of time brings back to me, an old man, the glow and thrill which I once felt, only to hear it repeated by a stranger. I am very glad you have changed it. Very, very.
This is all mighty fine, said Monks, to retain his assumed designation, after a long silence, during which he had jerked himself in sullen defiance to and fro, and Mr. Brownlow had sat shading his face with his hand.
But what do you want with me?
You have a brother, said Mr. Brownlow, rousing himself.
A brother, the whisper of whose name in your ear when I came behind you in the street was in itself almost enough to make you accompany me hither in wonder and alarm.
I have no brother, replied Monks. You know I was an only child. Why do you talk to me of brothers? You know that as well as I.
Attend to what I do know, and you may not, said Mr. Brownlow. I shall interest you by and by. I know that of the wretched marriage into which family pride and the most sordid and narrowest of all ambition forced your unhappy father when a mere boy, you were the sole and most unnatural issue.
I don't care for hard names, interrupted Monks with a jeering laugh. You know the fact, and that's enough for me.
But I also know, pursued the old gentleman, the misery, the slow torture, the protracted anguish of that ill-assorted union. I know how listlessly and wearily each of that wretched pair dragged on their heavy chain through a world that was poisoned to them both. I know how cold formalities were succeeded by open taunts, how indifference gave place to dislike, dislike to hate, and hate to loathing, until at last they wrenched the clanking bond asunder, and retiring a wide space apart, carried each a galling fragment, of which nothing but death could break the rivets, to hide it in new society beneath the gayest looks they could assume. Your mother succeeded. She forgot it soon, but it rusted and cankered at your father's heart for years.
Well, they were separated, said Monks.
And what of that?
When they had been separated for some time, returned Mr. Brownlow, and your mother, wholly given up to continental frivolities, had utterly forgotten the young husband, 10 good years her junior, who, with prospects blighted, lingered on at home, he fell among new friends. This circumstance, at least, you know already.
Not I, said Monks, turning away his eyes and beating his foot upon the ground, as a man who is determined to deny everything.
Not I. Your manner, no less than your actions, assures me that you have never forgotten it, or ceased to think of it with bitterness, returned Mr. Brownlow. I speak of 15 years ago. When you were not more than 11 years old, and your father but 31, for he was, I repeat, a boy when his father ordered him to marry. Must I go back to events which cast a shade upon the memory of your parent, or will you spare it and disclose to me the truth?
I have nothing to disclose, rejoined Monks. You must talk on if you will.
These new friends, then, said Mr. Brownlow, were a naval officer retired from active service, whose wife had died some half a year before, and left him with 2 children. There had been more, but of all their family, happily but 2 survived. They were both daughters, one a beautiful creature of 19, and the other a mere child of 2 or 3 years old.
What's this to me? Asked Monks.
They resided, said Mr. Brownlow, without seeming to hear the interruption, in a part of the country to which your father in his wandering had repaired, and where he had taken up his abode. Acquaintance, intimacy, friendship fast followed on each other. Your father was gifted as few men are. He had his sister's soul and person. As the old officer knew him more and more, he grew to love him. I would that it had ended there. His daughter did the same. The old gentleman paused,
Monks was biting his lips with his eyes fixed upon the floor. Seeing this, he immediately resumed.
The end of a year found him contracted, solemnly contracted to that daughter, the object of the first, true, ardent, only passion of a guileless girl.
End of side 12. Side 13.
Your tale is of the longest, observed Monks, moving restlessly in his chair.
It is a true tale of grief and trial and sorrow, young man, returned Mr. Brownlow, and such tales usually are. If it were one of unmixed joy and happiness, it would be very brief. At length, one of those rich relations, to strengthen whose interest and importance your father had been sacrificed, as others are often, it is no uncommon case, died, and to repair the misery he had been instrumental in occasioning, left him his panacea for all griefs, money. It was necessary that he should immediately repair to Rome, whither this man had sped for health, and where he had died, leaving his affairs in great confusion. He went, was seized with mortal illness there, was followed, the moment the intelligence reached Paris, by your mother, who carried you with her. He died the day after her arrival, leaving no will. No will, so that the whole property fell to her and you.
At this part of the recital, Monks held his breath and listened with a face of intense eagerness, though his eyes were not directed towards the speaker. As Mr. Brownlow paused, he changed his position with the air of one who has experienced a sudden relief and wiped his hot face and hands.
Before he went abroad, and as he passed through London on his way, said Mr. Brownlow slowly, and fixing his eyes upon the other's face, he came to me.
I never heard of that,
interrupted Monks in a tone intended to appear incredulous, but savouring more of disagreeable surprise.
He came to me, and left with me, among some other things, a picture, a portrait painted by himself, a likeness of this poor girl, which he did not wish to leave behind and could not carry forward on his hasty journey. He was worn by anxiety and remorse almost to a shadow, talked in a wild, distracted way of ruin and dishonour, worked by himself, confided to me his intention to convert his whole property at any loss into money, and having settled on his wife and you a portion of his recent acquisition to fly the country. I guessed too well he would not fly alone, and never see it more. Even from me, his old and early friend, whose strong attachment had taken root in the earth that covered one most dear to both, even from me he withheld any more particular confession, promising to write and tell me all, and after that to see me once again for the last time on earth. Alas, that was the last time. I had no letter, and I never saw him more. I went, said Mr. Brownlow, after a short pause, I went, when all was over, to the scene of his, I will use the term the world would freely use, for worldly harshness or favour are now alike to him, of his guilty love, resolved that, if my fears were realised, that erring child should find one heart and home to shelter and compassionate her. The family had left that part a week before. They had called in such trifling debts as were outstanding, discharged them, and left the place by night.
Why or whither, none can tell. Monks drew his breath yet more freely and looked round with a smile of triumph. When your brother, said Mr. Brownlow, drawing nearer to the other's chair, when your brother, a feeble, ragged, neglected child, was cast in my way by a stronger hand than chance, and rescued by me from a life of vice and infamy.
What? Cried Monks.
By me, said Mr. Brownlow.
I told you I should interest you before long. I say, by me. I see that your cunning associate suppressed my name, although for aught he knew it would be quite strange to your ears. When he was rescued by me, then, and lay recovering from sickness in my house, his strong resemblance to this picture I have spoken of struck me with astonishment.
Even when I first saw him in all his dirt and misery, there was a lingering expression in his face that came upon me like a glimpse of some old friend flashing on one in a vivid dream. I need not tell you he was snared away before I knew his history.
"Why not?" asked Monks hastily. "Because you know it well."
"I? Denial to me is vain," replied Mr. Brownlow. "I shall show you that I know more than that."
You can't prove anything against me," stammered Monks. "I defy you to do it."
"We shall see," returned the old gentleman with a searching glance. "I lost the boy, and no efforts of mine could recover him. Your mother being dead, I knew that you alone could solve the mystery if anybody could. And as, when I had last heard of you, you were on your own estate in the West Indies, whither, as you well know, you retired upon your mother's death to escape the consequences of vicious courses here, I made the voyage. You had left it months before, and were supposed to be in London, but no one could tell where. I returned. Your agents had no clue to your residence. You came and went, they said, as strangely as you had ever done, sometimes for days together, and sometimes not for months, keeping to all appearance the same low haunts and mingling with the same infamous herd who had been your associates when a fierce, ungovernable boy. I wearied them with new applications. I paced the streets by night and day, but until 2 hours ago all my efforts were fruitless, and I never saw you for an instant.
And now you do see me, said Monks, rising boldly. What then? Fraud and robbery are high-sounding words, justified, you think, by a fancied resemblance in some young imp to an idle daub of a dead man's. Brother, you don't even know that a child was born of this maudlin pair. You don't even know that.
I did not, replied Mr. Brownlow, rising too. But within the last fortnight I have learnt it all. You have a brother. You know it and him. There was a will which your mother destroyed, leaving the secret and the gain to you at her own death. It contained a reference to some child likely to be the result of this sad connection, which child was born and accidentally encountered by you when your suspicions were first awakened by his resemblance to his father. You repaired to the place of his birth. There existed proofs long suppressed of his birth and parentage. Those proofs were destroyed by you, and now, in your own words to your accomplice, the Jew, the only proofs of the boy's identity lie at the bottom of the river, and the old hag that received them from the mother is rotting in her coffin. Unworthy son, coward, liar, you who hold your counsels with thieves and murderers in dark rooms at night, you whose plots and wiles have brought a violent death upon the head of one worth millions such as you. You, who from your cradle were gall and bitterness to your own father's heart, and in whom all evil passions, vice, and profligacy festered, till they found a vent in a hideous disease, which has made your face an index even to your mind. You, Edward Leaford, do you still brave me?
No, no, no,
returned the coward, overwhelmed by these accumulated charges. Every word, cried the old gentleman, every word that has passed between you and this detested villain is known to me. Shadows on the wall have caught your whispers and brought them to my ear. The sight of the persecuted child has turned vice itself and given it the courage and almost the attributes of virtue. Murder has been done, to which you were morally, if not really, a party.
No, no, interposed Monks. I know nothing of that. I was going to inquire the truth of the story when you overtook me. I didn't know the cause. I thought it was a common quarrel.
It was the partial disclosure of your secrets, replied Mr. Brownlow.
Will you disclose the whole?
Yes, I will. Set your hand to a statement of truth and facts, and repeat it before witnesses.
That I promise too.
Remain quietly here until such a document is drawn up, and proceed with me to such a place as I may deem most advisable for the purpose of attesting it.
If you insist upon that, I'll do that also, replied Monks.
You must do more than that, said Mr. Brownlow. Make restitution to an innocent and unoffending child, for such he is,
although the offspring of a guilty and most miserable love. You have not forgotten the provisions of the will. Carry them into execution so far as your brother is concerned, and then go where you please. In this world you need meet no more. While Monks was pacing up and down, meditating with dark and evil looks on this proposal, and the possibilities of evading it, torn by his fears on the one hand and his hatred on the other, the door was hurriedly unlocked, and a gentleman, Mr. Losburne, entered the room in violent agitation. "The man will be taken!" he cried. "He will be taken tonight!" "The murderer?" asked Mr. Brownlow. "Yes, yes," replied the other. "His dog has been seen lurking about some old haunt, and there seems little doubt that his master either is or will be there under cover of the darkness. Spies are hovering about in every direction. I have spoken to the men who are charged with his capture, and they tell me he cannot escape. A reward of £100 is proclaimed by government tonight." "I will give 50 more," said Mr. Brownlow, "and proclaim it with my own lips upon the spot, if I can reach it. Where is Mr. Maylie? Harry, as soon as he had seen your friend here, safe in a coach with you, he hurried off to where he heard this," replied the doctor, "and, mounting his horse, sallied forth to join the first party at some place in the outskirts agreed upon between them." "Fagin," said Mr. Brownlow, "what of him? When I last heard, he had not been taken, but he will be or is by this time. They're sure of him." "Have you made up your mind?" asked Mr. Brownlow in a low voice of Monks. "Yes," he replied. You will be secret with me?"
"I will. Remain here till I return. It is your only hope of safety."
They left the room, and the door was again locked. "What have you done?" asked the doctor in a whisper.
"All that I could hope to do, and even more. Coupling the poor girl's intelligence with my previous knowledge, and the result of our good friend's inquiries on the spot, I left him no loophole of escape, and laid bare the whole villainy, which by these lights became plain as day. Write and appoint the evening after tomorrow at 7 for the meeting. We shall be down there a few hours before, but shall require rest, especially the young lady, who may have greater need of firmness than either you or I can quite foresee just now. But my blood boils to avenge this poor murdered creature. Which way have they taken?
Drive straight to the office, and you will be in time," replied Mr. Losburne. "I will remain here." The two gentlemen hastily separated, each in a fever of excitement wholly uncontrollable. Chapter 50. The Pursuit and Escape. Near to that part of the Thames on which the church at Rotherhithe abuts, where the buildings on the banks are dirtiest, and the vessels on the river blackest with the dust of colliers and the smoke of close-built low-roofed houses, there exists the filthiest, the strangest, the most extraordinary of the many localities that are hidden in London, wholly unknown, even by name, to the great mass of its inhabitants. To reach this place, the visitor has to penetrate through a mass of close, narrow, and muddy streets, thronged by the roughest and poorest of waterside people, and devoted to the traffic they may be supposed to occasion. The cheapest and least delicate provisions are heaped in the shops. The coarsest and commonest articles of wearing apparel dangle at the salesman's door, and stream from the house parapet and windows. Jostling with unemployed labourers of the lowest class, ballast heavers, coal whippers, brazen women, ragged children, and the raff and refuse of the river, he makes his way with difficulty along, assailed by offensive sights and smells from the narrow alleys which branch off on the right and left, and deafened by the clash of ponderous wagons that bear great piles of merchandise from the stacks of warehouses that rise from every corner. Arriving at length, in streets remoter and less frequented than those through which he has passed, he walks beneath tottering house fronts projecting over the pavement, dismantled walls that seem to totter as he passes, chimneys half crushed, half hesitating to fall, windows guarded by rusty iron bars that time and dirt have almost eaten away, every imaginable sign of desolation and neglect. In such a neighbourhood, beyond Dockhead in the borough of Southwark, stands Jacob's Island, surrounded by a muddy ditch 6 or 8 feet deep and 15 or 20 wide when the tide is in, once called Mill Pond,
but known in the days of this story as Folly Ditch. It is a creek or inlet from the Thames, and can always be filled at high water by opening the sluices at the lead mills, from which it took its old name. At such times, a stranger, looking from one of the wooden bridges thrown across it at Mill Lane, will see the inhabitants of the houses on either side lowering from their back doors and windows buckets, pails, domestic utensils of all kinds, in which to haul the water up. And when his eyes turn from these operations to the houses themselves, his utmost astonishment will be excited by the scene before him. Crazy wooden galleries common to the backs of half a dozen houses, with holes from which to look upon the slime beneath. Windows broken and patched, with poles thrust out, on which to dry the linen that is never there. Rooms so small, so filthy, so confined, that the air would seem too tainted even for the dirt and squalor which they shelter. Wooden chambers thrusting themselves out above the mud, and threatening to fall into it, as some have done. Dirt-besmeared walls and decaying foundations, every repulsive lineament of poverty, every loathsome indication of filth, rot, and garbage, all these ornament the banks of Folly Ditch. In Jacob's Island, the warehouses are roofless and empty. The walls are crumbling down. The windows are windows no more. The doors are falling into the streets. The chimneys are blackened, but they yield no smoke. 30 or 40 years ago, before losses and chancery suits came upon it, it was a thriving place. But now it is a desolate island indeed. The houses have no owners. They are broken open and entered upon by those who have the courage, and there they live, and there they die. They must have powerful motives for a secret residence, or be reduced to a destitute condition indeed, who seek a refuge in Jacob's Island. In an upper room of one of these houses, a detached house of fair size, ruinous in other respects, but strongly defended at door and window, of which house the back commanded the ditch, in manner already described, there were assembled three men, who, regarding each other every now and then with looks expressive of perplexity and expectation, sat for some time in profound and gloomy silence. One of these was Toby Crackit, another Mr. Chitling, and the third a robber of 50 years, whose nose had been almost beaten in some old scuffle, and whose face bore a frightful scar, which might probably be traced to the same occasion. This man was a returned transport, and his name was Caggs. "I wish," said Toby, turning to Mr. Chitling, "that you had picked out some other crib when the two old ones got too warm and had not come here, my fine fellow." "Why didn't you, blunderhead?" said Caggs. "Well, I thought you'd have been a little more glad to see me than this," replied Mr. Chitling, with a melancholy air. "Why, looky, young gentleman," said Toby, "when a man keeps himself so very exclusive as I have done, and by that means has a snug house over his head with nobody a-prying and smelling about it, it's rather a startling thing to have the honour of a visit from a young gentleman, however respectable and pleasant a person he may be to play cards with at conveniency, circumstanced as you are, especially when the exclusive young man has got a friend stopping with him that's arrived sooner than was expected from foreign parts and is too modest to want to be presented to the judges on his return," added Mr. Caggs. There was a short silence, after which Toby Crackit, seeming to abandon as hopeless any further effort to maintain his usual devil-may-care swagger, turned to Chitling and said, "When was Fagin took, then?" "Just at dinner-time, 2 o'clock this afternoon, Charlie and I made our lucky up the wash-house chimney, and Bolter got into the empty water-butt, head downwards, but his legs were so precious long that they stuck out at the top, and so they took him too." "And Bet?" "Poor Bet. She went to see the body, to speak to who it was," replied Chitling, his countenance falling more and more, "and went off mad, screaming and raving and beating her head against the boards, so they put a straight waistcoat on her, and took her to the hospital, and there she is."
"What's come of young Bates?" demanded Caggs.
"He hung about, not to come over here afore dark, but he'll be here soon," replied Chitling. "There's nowhere else to go to now, for the people at the Cripples are all in custody, and the bar of the Ken, I went up there and see it with my own eyes, is filled with traps."
"This is a smash," observed Toby, biting his lips. "There's more than one will go with this."
"The sessions are on," said Caggs. "If they get the inquest over and Bolter turns King's evidence, and of course